Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
This is my introduction for episode 90 of the podcast. I hope these introductions make sense to you, or maybe you just skip past them. I probably wouldn't blame you, but it's nice to set the scene, set the stage a little bit. My name's Dave, by the way. I'm the host. So I'm going to set the scene for you. This was a talk that was recorded by Shastri Ethan Nichtern at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York at our weekly Dharma gathering. This happens in our main space at the Shambhala Meditation Center. It's a room full of people, very earnest, engaged, people who have been meditating for a long time, people who are brand new to meditation. They come, they meditate for a while, they get instruction if they're new, and then they hear a talk. And this was the night for Shastri Ethan Nichtern to present his topic, Buddha with a Smartphone. What does that mean? Well, you have to listen to the talk. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting its introductory weekend meditation program. It's called Shambhala Training Level 1, and we present it a few times a year. The next time is going to be the weekend of March 18th. So maybe you want to plan for that weekend if you've been thinking about doing this for a while. If you've never heard of it, well, it's a weekend where you get an introduction or a deepening of meditation practice in the context of the Shambhala teachings on how to cope with the half-eaten chocolate cookie crunch cake that's sitting on the top of your refrigerator while you're trying to record a podcast introduction, for example. That's just where I'm at right now, just laying it out there. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org. Click Classes and Programs. And now, Shastri Ethan Nichtern, as you know, is a regular contributor to the podcast. He is the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. He is the author of One City, A Declaration of Interdependence. And he is talking to you right now.
Did you ever wonder, I mean, maybe you're brand new to meditation, but maybe you're getting into it because somebody else said it was good. But did you ever have the skeptical thought, what could possibly be relevant to my life of any ideas that come from 2,600 years ago? It's a good thought to have. Like, what could this possibly have to do with us or me? I've had that thought. A few of my favorite Dharma books start with that, right? They didn't even have paper. Paper is new. It's about 300 years after the time of the Buddha, the widespread use of paper supposedly started. So let's talk about what isn't new, and then maybe that can lead us into a discussion of what is new. And there's a lot of ways to talk about Buddhist teachings that are still relevant. I mean, I think that's why we're all here, looking for something human, some way to be with ourselves, some way to be present, some way to be compassionate, some way to get to know our own mind, some way to communicate thoughtfully and skillfully with other people. And all of this stuff was taught in 6th century BCE northern India, even though there was so much different. But I think the simplest way to talk about what hasn't changed, and this may be too simple for you, is this simple word in Buddhism, dukkha, D-U-H-K-H-A is usually the way the Sanskrit is transliterated. And this word literally means something like misalignment or bad space. There's two ways that this word is most often translated into English. It's either dissatisfaction or suffering. I don't love the translation suffering. I prefer dissatisfaction. And the reason I don't love the translation suffering is I think we often think of very intensive situations as suffering. you know, we don't think of like this line at Trader Joe's is longer than I thought it was going to be. But how the mind responds to that could be dukkha. And if you watch, if you ever watch the people in line at Trader Joe's, which is kind of what meditation is, you're watching the person struggling rather than being the person struggling, although you're both. It could be very much dukkha, right? Although after class it tends to be better. But then the brownies pose different problems. So I want to be really clear, because I think this is so often miscommunicated and mistranslated, that dukkha does not mean pain. It's not ouch. Life includes a lot of ouch moments. Has anybody had an ouch moment recently? Do you find it hard to get to your practice when you're not having an ouch moment? Like when there's sort of a good number of ouch moments to have to give us perspective. Too many, there's not enough space or enough appreciation, and too few, it's just things are a little too on autopilot. We get very unrealistic without, we get incredibly burdened and traumatized if there's too many ouch moments, and we get really unrealistic if there are too few. So it's good to have, there's like a sweet spot. But ouch in and of itself, like I stub my toe, I feel sad, somebody passed away, I just got the stomach flu, which I did, that is not alone dukkha. Dukkha refers to the moment where we thought ouch was going to make us happy. It's where we thought the ouch was going to be something different. Right? So there's a dukkha always refers to a kind of confusion. It's not just the state of things as they are. It's a very common, incredibly common, confused approach to things as they are. And one of the things that I find, the Buddha, since he thought he was completely awakened, meaning the historical Buddha, there have been many Buddhas throughout history in many different traditions, many awakened beings, but Shakyamuni Buddha at one point said that his teachings on suffering, dukkha, and the alleviation of dukkha would be true in any possible universe. Like, have you ever thought about like how aliens would meditate? Like, if an alien had, we wouldn't be really worried about lotus posture if we had seven legs and 17 eyes, but there would still be some process of working with dukkha, right? So same way, you could say going from the Iron Age to this really interesting, often very painful, interwoven global environment. What the Buddha said is, yeah, you might have smartphones now, but dukkha is still part of the thing, maybe the whole thing that we need to become students of. So it's said that he also said there's either 3 or 8 types of dukkha. So I figured it'd be good to geek out a little bit each of these talks. I know they're public, but are you guys interested in the 8 types of dukkha that the Buddha taught? I think it was more than 3 people, but you 3 are just really into it, which is good because you're sitting in front. So the tricky thing about the 8 types of dukkha is the way they're defined is by the moment in life where it could present dukkha. These moments by themselves are usually an ouch moment, but it's where the mind tends to project confusion onto the moment, and therefore these are the moments we have to be really wary of to know that dukkha is going to happen. So that's the tricky thing, is sometimes it's called the dukkha. The first one is the dukkha of birth, right? Which isn't to say that being born is suffering. It's to say being born is painful, or having a new thing come into being is painful. And there's a certain type of suffering or confused dissatisfaction that can arise in that space. So being born both refers to, there's these descriptions in classical Buddhism of like being born feeling like being crushed between two mountains, and that's for the child, never mind the mother, right? I've heard personal descriptions from many friends about that pain, that ouch. Seems pretty immeasurable. But yet, here we are, 7 billion of us. So it must be workable. That's the good news. There's a sense of the suffering and confusion that can arise when a new situation comes into being. So the birth of a relationship, even though it can have a lot of great connection and admiration, and if it's a romantic relationship, romance could have some dukkha when you're figuring out how to bring something new into being, a project. Is anyone trying to give birth to a creative project? Is there any dukkha, any confused ouch, not pure ouch? Right. So birth, aging is the second one in any universe. And this is often described, the Buddha actually saw, supposedly as a young man, an elderly person. And it was the first, he had a very narcissistic father, the more mythological stories go, I don't know how true they were, who tried to shield him from suffering because he thought it would turn him into a spiritual person and he wanted him to inherit the family real estate. So that's interesting. If you don't want to become a spiritual person, don't pay attention to reality. Right? So he saw an elderly person, right? So old age, but it's also can refer to any period of transition where the feeling of what used to happen is shifting, is no longer applicable, maybe degrading, right? Maybe something that used to work is not working anymore. So the pain of aging, the dukkha of aging is when that turns into, I'm watching a lot of my parents' generation go through the ouch of aging and seem to be doing a really great job, at least externally, working with and maybe lessening the dukkha of aging, like just working with it with a lot of humor and dignity. And that's the other thing I think that applies for me in any universe or would is humor about ouch. Birth, aging, illness. Very simple. Got the stomach flu last week, then got food poisoning Sunday night. That was my week. And I could, you know, we could talk about our friends who have more serious illnesses that are not so easy to bounce back from. Talk to a student who has a young child whose classmate, I think is 5 or 6 years old, is dying of cancer. Right. We could think of all of the places in the world where seemingly avoidable illness happens. I think about in this city, as somebody who has asthma, all the places where childhood asthma is too high just in this city and people can't afford the ridiculous pharmaceuticals. The price of asthma medicine is, my medicine's like $200. So what do you do if you can't get the medicine and you don't have a way to work with your mind? That's the ouch plus the confusion. Death. Things end. Everything ends. Every sentient being that takes birth dies. All right, so I can feel the sort of shroud coming over the room. Yeah, that's only 4 of them. Those are like the life transition ones. Now we just get into the like day by day ones. So the fifth one is, let me make sure I get the order. Fifth one is not getting what you want. Wanting something and not being able to possess it, wanting someone and not being able to possess them. So now it's getting more day by day. Ouch. It's interesting. Maybe that's funnier because it's more day by day, and the others were more like, oh boy, that's where I'm headed, huh? It's like, this is just a Tuesday, right? Not getting what you want. The sixth one, you can maybe guess, is getting what you don't want. I really want this person's attention, and then irritating person X enters our field. Getting what you don't want. And then the seventh one is being separated from that which you love. So you got what you wanted, you had it for a while, and then you lose it. And the eighth one, which is kind of the favorite one, because it's the deepest one, which is, this is sometimes referred to as all-pervasive dukkha. In one text, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the founder of our tradition, translates it as general misery. But it really has a quality of any time the mind tries to hold together conditions, it's like a kind of we're trying to, like, I don't know, like hold together sand with super glue. And maybe it works a little bit, but it just doesn't work. Anytime we try to fix that which is not fixable, we suffer. And this is, you could say, the suffering of holding together the conditional or all-pervasive suffering. The reason it's all-pervasive is it happens a lot. All right. And that's, it's sort of like when people talk about anxiety as sort of like a low-level anxiety of just like, I don't even know what I'm nervous about. A lot of people report, and not even people who have more acute anxiety, but and this might just be a New York condition as well, or a modern condition. It might be more intense than it was in the ancient world. I'm not sure. I don't have the way to know that, but that sort of feeling like it's falling apart. I don't know how to hold it together. And then I think what a lot of low-level anxiety is about is then there's this added storyline of it's all going to fall apart. I don't know how to hold it together, and therefore I am screwed up. And the first two sentences are completely accurate. Right? It's all going to fall apart. I don't know how to hold it together. That's just insight. Therefore, I'm screwed up is what we call in the Shambhala tradition self-aggression. Totally unnecessary, but a deeply learned habitual pattern. So those eight said you could construct, you could get as fantasy as you want. You could go into whatever Star Wars universe, whatever Game of Thrones universe, whatever universe you want to create. Those eight would define the struggles of the beings in that universe. It's kind of amazing that he said this is true of any universe, the truth of dukkha. So let's talk about what's new. And I feel like we're going to have to bring some lightness to this because there is a lot of positivity here, because the notion is that if we could lessen dukkha, not that we would feel a life without ouch, because that's impossible, but we would really appreciate our life a lot more. Just even if you could lessen dukkha 10%, you would be like the happiest person in your family. Maybe you already are, I don't know. But so what is it that's new about the modern era? There's a couple things, I think, in terms of just, there's a lot that's new. I'll just share with you my list, and I think I was thinking more generally, but I loved your all lists. So I had democracy, capitalism, the identity movements that were mentioned, culture. I think we have a lot more art, culture, narrative, every kind of creative form that exists, we have a lot more of. Everybody in this room was alive in the era when David Bowie was alive. The Buddha was not, right? So we have David Bowie. So there's a lot of very positive. I think when you get into that stuff, the sense of the life expectancy of our world overall is much higher. I think the sense of a general scientific and spiritual freedom, although it does not apply to everyone, is probably a lot higher, that you didn't have to buy, you don't have to buy a story about the universe in order to not be persecuted, which the story in the ancient Indian system was that there were four castes of people who each emanated from God, Brahma's body. And then there was a fifth caste, the outcasts, who were said not to even be born of Brahma. So they literally had a story that your essence was based on a certain part of God's body. And if you were from a certain part of God's body, you were higher. And there were some people who weren't even from God. Right? That's a very rigid narrative, right? And so I do think we live in an era where, at least in the world we inhabit, there's the ability to not have to immediately buy a story about the universe. Same thing in medieval Europe, right? The church owns you. And so I think this is interesting then coming to anything that looks like a spiritual tradition. You're like, well, I spent so much time declaring my freedom from some spiritual narrative, and now you want me to bow? I think we have to find a way to, in whatever spiritual rituals or ceremonies we take on, we have to find a way to find our own sense of heart and humanity and our own sense of purpose in those. Otherwise, what's the point? It's just buying another story. So I think that's a big difference. Technology, I think, is a huge one. There was a prophecy by the master, the Tibetan master, Padmasambhava, born of a lotus is what his name means. He's considered like the second Buddha, the tantric master who really helped Buddhism land in Tibet. And he was considered a completely enlightened master, lived in the 7th century, and he had these prophecies of a coming dark age, which throughout Asian yogic Buddhist history, there's this notion of we have our apocalypse fantasies, right? So they had what was called the Kali Yuga, the dark age. And there was, so he had a prophecy that the coming dark age, a couple things were going to happen. One was that it was going to become easier and easier for people to distract themselves. More and more available to just get out of the present moment anytime you wanted to. And two, the other thing, which I think of this in a lot of different communities that I'm involved in, that even when people had similar positive, compassionate intentions, it would be hard to communicate well with each other. And so people with the same intention would work at cross purposes to each other. The Shambhala teachings kind of further this by really placing an emphasis on how modern culture aids our sense of self-aggression, that feeling of I'm not good enough, I am not basically good, right? Which is interesting to introduce this notion of Buddha nature, or we all have awakened nature, into certain cultural elements that seem sometimes designed to say you're not good enough. Do you all feel that one? That's a hard one to think about. Buddha nature in a culture of I'm not good enough. Does anyone really not face that I'm not good enough thing? I mean, maybe you could find somebody you know who's like, no, I'm great. His name is Jay-Z. LeBron James, yeah. So there's certain cultural arenas where that might be acceptable, right? Yeah. Sports, yeah. Yeah, you don't know what they're feeling underneath or if that's a kind of a coping mechanism, right? But most people I know feel more often this kind of self-aggression of like, I screwed up again. And then I think the difficult thing for us is the beautiful thing about Buddhism, the beautiful thing about the Shambhala teachings is we don't believe in original sin. We believe in basic goodness and the enlightened potential of all sentient beings. But I think the problem in our advertising culture is that then if that gets mixed with an self-aggression of I'm not good enough, we can actually start to beat ourselves up with Buddha nature. What I see happening for a lot of, for myself and other people is, all right, I'm basically good. I'm an okay human being. I have awakened nature. I could completely become enlightened someday. There is nothing wrong with me. Shit, I screwed up again. How could I possibly forget my Buddha nature again? It's almost worse in the face of self-aggression to know that your nature is good, wholesome, wise, compassionate, strong, because then you can always diminish yourself against that nature. So it's really good to drop your belief in original sin, but don't use basic goodness as a way to beat yourself up. But I think that's something we have to face. There seems to be increased pace, and within that pace, increased self-aggression. Not a different nature. I think we're still in any universe, a being who is confused about ouch, blames themselves for things that are just what life is. But the pace and the structure of our society seems to create more daggers of self-aggression. So what I would offer is that you really focus this year, if you feel like it, on setting up or reconnecting to a daily practice on the cushion. But I would also say let's work with the arenas that are new about 2016. And I would just especially offer, just because it's simple, it's close to you, that you work with your tech device. That's why I call this Buddha with a smartphone. Because there is no, for most, maybe for a few people, you're like, I don't do that. I still have a flip phone. I look like a drug dealer from 2002. It's cool. I only, if it's absolutely necessary, right, do I use it. But for 98% of people in the room, the one device that is the throughout the day sort of vehicle and vessel of our sense of attentiveness, compassion towards ourself, connection with other human beings is your tech device. And I would just say, I mean, there are lots of ways we can do this and some things that have worked for me, but turn that into a practice arena. Study the dukkha of your tech device. This is interesting. I think Georgia might be live tweeting this talk right now. I don't know. Are you? I want to know. So just because I'm like a postmodern thinking dude, like what happens when you live tweet somebody mentioning they're being live tweeted? Okay, so it just goes back and back. Okay, cool. Right. Hashtags are great if you want to bring people together. The only problem with a hashtag is at some point you just have to say what you have to say. It's good if we hashtag so we all know we're here, we can support each other's practice, right? That's a good thing. But at a certain point, we just have to kind of be, too. So I want to leave some time for discussion, but I hope at least to get a little bit of the classical Dharma, the eight types of suffering, was helpful. And I also want to hear what you think makes it easier or harder to practice nowadays. And you know, how we can support each other working with that. And there's one last thing I want to say, but I'll say it after we have a little discussion.
Hi, Ethan. Could you get a little bit more specific in ways that you're mindful with your phone?
Yeah.
As like practical tools?
Yeah. Airplane mode when you're not on an airplane. Yeah, that should be called mindful mode or something. You know, I find that most of the tech, like I have an iPhone, and it has the tools to help you use it mindfully. None of those are the default setting. The default setting of every app you download is like, do you want to get 17,000 notifications? And you have to turn those off. Maybe it's turning the phone off, you know. But I think it's good to have periods of time where you're not, where you're present, you know. Or at least, how about this? One of your two commutes, if you are often on your phone or reading or texting or listening to something, if you have two commutes in the day, one of the two of them just practice being present. So no phone. And the other one you can, you know, listen to whatever the kids are listening to nowadays. I don't know. What should I be listening to now that Bowie's gone? Bowie. Good. Good answer. Yeah, is that, I mean, you can come up, once you look at it and say, which of the eight types of suffering does this bring me? And also, which of the types of joy and connection does this bring me? Because that's the other thing. We live in a very, it's not just confusion and it's not just wisdom, right? These two facets of our life, it's not just aggression and compassion. It's like everything's happening in such an entwined way, which is why it's said that the tantric teachings, which look at not things as destructive, but things as pure energy that can either be used creatively or destructively, samsarically, is such an important way of looking at the world for this era. But if you look and say, how is this bringing me dukkha and how can I work with that, then I think you'll develop your own. But definitely part of it is being unreachable sometimes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wanted to add to the discussion this Buddhist-friendly writer 200 years ago, Henry David Thoreau, said our technological improvements are an improved means to an unimproved ends.
Yeah. That's also, I think there's a Dr. King quote and a Dalai Lama quote that basically say the same thing, which is about this era in human history, about the, I like the Dr. King version, but it's about war technology rather than smartphone. But the notion is that we're living in an era where our sort of emotional, spiritual, psychological intelligence is being greatly outpaced by our technological intelligence. So we're learning how to do all these things, but not how to handle the ability to do it. So the Dr. King quote, he says, we have guided missiles and misguided men. But to put that just into the social networking terms, maybe we shouldn't give the power to somebody to be able to communicate with 4,000 people simultaneously who hasn't learned how to work with their own emotions around feeling slightly insulted because somebody said something. Maybe we should wait until we have really good, compassionate tools for emotional awareness and appropriate speech before we give that power of communication to ourselves. Right. I mean, we're already here, so we can't, like, take away. I don't know if we can take back people's guns. We definitely can't take back their smartphones, right? So we just have to work with things as they are.
As I was thinking about the concept that you said of a dark age,
yeah,
I think it's for some, maybe very appealing to think this is something like a dark age, because I do think there is more opportunity for dukkha the more technology there is, because I think it gives us a false sense of control.
Mm.
And then you become dissatisfied when you find out, especially in those moments of transition, that you're not in control. But at the same time, kind of like he mentioned, there are apps or right. there's the internet that gets you to find out about Shambhala or something like that. So I feel that at the end of the day, it evens out
mm-hmm.
the fact that, yes, there's all this distraction, but there's also all this information that right. gets you there.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. And it's so what determines whether it's used well or used poorly, it's the mind that uses it, you know, which means the mind that's using it has to have some tools or some training to work with things as they are.
Well, I find some of the memes to be kind of helpful. Like, one thing is, like, I'm sure everybody has a tendency to, like, argue with people on the internet, right?
And so no, never.
No, nobody identifies with. Okay. But there's, like, this thing that sort of floats around that says, like, oh, no, someone was wrong on the internet, mm-hmm. right? And so that kind of acts like a slogan for me. It's like every time I find myself going like that, it's like, oh no, someone was wrong on the internet.
Mm.
And so that just kind of creates, it makes it a little slower.
Mm.
Yeah.
Meaning having that slogan to contemplate someone was wrong on the internet.
Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, that's that phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
Somebody's always going to be wrong on the internet.
Right.
So you don't get so caught up.
Yeah, and it's also like, are they wrong?
Mm.
You know, because everybody's got their own thing going on, right?
Right.
So, like, everybody's wrong on the internet.
Yeah. Amen. It's a new meme. Everybody's wrong on the internet.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this idea of connections enabled through technology. Because,
yeah.
you know, you've got your 4,000 friends on Facebook.
Right.
And you're really close to all of them. You know, and so sometimes...
Oh, come on.
You know?
All of
sometimes
them?
You can feel like you're having just like these virtual conversations, these virtual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
How real are they? And
yeah.
I know it's variable, but then because it's also... Maybe there is 3,000 miles separating you from someone and technology can enable you to have deeper, deeper relationships than you
yeah.
otherwise would.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's like confusion there, I think.
Yeah.
From that.
Yeah. I think the confusion part is the part we have to work with. Yeah. Like, I think if you have 4,000 friends, you can, like, I think it's sort of amazing when, let's say, if you were a David Bowie fan, which a lot of people clearly were, to actually be able to share that in a much more public, much more interactive forum. I mean, it's amazing, mm-hmm. you know, that... And it would feel very what's the term, like Luddite or kind of anti-modernity, which some people would accuse like Tibet of being very anti-modernity, and it would feel sort of like grumpy, you know, curmudgeon to say like, oh, Facebook or the internet isn't good for that. So, but I think it's very hard to have deep connections when the pace is that quick. So, I think it is useful to me if those things spark deep, genuine human connections, and I think they can, but it can also create, as long as we're not confused about the level of connection we're going to and we still aspire to deeper connections, I think it's great. I think we'll probably live in an era where it will get easier and easier to mistake those more, I don't mean superficial in a bad way, just more passing connections as real life. And then I do worry about people within that space. Like, one of the biggest human qualities that these teachings bring out is empathy and compassion. Like, the ability to really, like, contemplate somebody or sit with somebody and, like, really think about what are they experiencing, you know? Not just like, oh, sorry about your mom. Like, what does that actually feel like to be a human being having human experiences? And so... if things get too fast-paced and there's no forums for slowing down and connecting, then I just worry that we're going to sort of dampen the meaning of connection. I don't mean to sound like an old curmudgeon saying that, but I, you know, I like my Facebook friends too. I just, it's if somebody's a close friend and I haven't seen them in a while or talked to them in a while, it feels like something's missing. And I think that's because mindfulness and empathy thrive on a more immersive experience, you know.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for the talk. I wanted to address one of the dukkha moments that you talked about, where I guess it's a pervasive one, where we go from things are falling apart, I can't hold them, therefore I'm not good enough.
Right.
Which I think saying I'm not good enough is just another way of saying I feel ashamed. So I'm curious, from your experience, what practice have you found effective with dealing directly with that shame?
With shame, yeah. Well, in meditation or in life?
Any.
Yeah, so the meditation practices, there are several. They work at different levels. That's the thing I love about this tradition, and I'm not just saying that because I teach in it, but there's different levels of kind of the same practice that goes deeper. So there are practices for contemplating one's confused karmic deeds, and instead of working with shame, working with a kind of healthy or positive remorse, generating like, oh, I made a mistake and I would like to do things differently next time. There are, from the compassion practices, there are practices like forgiveness meditation, Tonglen, sending and taking meditation, which a lot of times people think is only a compassion practice for other people, but I think it's actually can be the most powerful if you do it for yourself, which is what the ancient text says, to always start with yourself, and then everyone forgets that part. It's like the first line of the text. And then there's a Vajrayana practice when you get deeper along the path, which is a visualization practice for purifying the sense that there's any mistake about us at all, while still acknowledging that we make mistakes. And that's called Vajrasattva purification. So all of those have been helpful. I would probably, if you have received any of the compassion practices, I would start with that towards yourself. And if you're having a hard time doing it, one of the ways to do compassion meditation is to do it for everyone who's like you, which is sometimes easier to do than for you. So if you made a particular kind of mistake that you're ashamed of, if you think of every other fool who made that mistake today, it's, for some weird reason, it's often easier to generate compassion for all the other fools than it is for yourself, but that can open the door. In terms of life, I would just say, you know, make the mistake again and see that it's workable. And if there's something you can do to lessen the dukkha, to harm yourself less or harm others less, then do that. And if you're not able to do it, make the mistake again. And if there's something you can do to lessen the dukkha for yourself or for others, you know. I wish I had a simpler answer than that. I wish it was like, go to SoulCycle, they'll get you. Which can be very helpful. Some of my Buddhist friends love SoulCycle, even though SoulCycle is a literal translation of samsara. But I wish we had a version of that 45-minute class, just get you laced up, as my barber likes to say, and out the door. But I've been meditating seriously for about 20 years really, since I was 17, and I still make a lot of mistakes. So I've gotten better with them. A lot of what's happened is a sense of humor around the shame part, you know, because you realize it's like, I probably made a bunch of mistakes tonight, and then it's like, it's not even in front of one person or two people, it's in front of like 150 people, and I'm sorry. I'll do better next time, I'll try. Please give me feedback, and we'll keep working. So I think once you buy that you're going to be on this path longer than 45 minutes, it all becomes workable. And then you have friends who are doing the same thing, and you just support each other, and it's like that. So I hope that's helpful. Maybe one more, and then we'll call it a night. Right over here.
I think this is related, but I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more around the idea of where that tendency towards self-aggression comes from. Because I keep looking for the root of something like that, and I'm not sure where it starts.
Yeah. Well, I think from the in any universe, this is true approach, you know, whatever the cultural setup and sort of, you know, familial structures a sentient being grew up with. From the in any universe approach, I think self-aggression is just the basis of it is I'm supposed to be feeling good and I'm not, therefore there must be something wrong with my experience. And I think that would be true. That part is true of, you know, person in 6th century India, Nepal, as it is here. I think there are definitely some ways to talk about how the our culture accentuates that we share a lot of messages that have the impact of you're not doing good enough. There is somebody who's doing good enough. You could break off a little piece of them, but only for a moment. And the whole thing feels very unstable. So I don't know which field, like we could have a whole critique of like advertising culture in that if you wanted to, or expectations of different people in society based on social expectations. But I think that's all true, and it's really important to study that as a modern Buddhist practitioner. But sometimes I like to just go back to the this is the nature of dukkha approach, right? The mind thinks it's supposed to be having an experience that it's not, and therefore the mind attacks itself. Last thought.
The self-aggression we all feel has to be evidence of the aggression that we're in.
Yeah.
Like you're cold, you feel cold because it's cold outside.
Exactly, yeah.
It's evidence of human, we're so susceptible as humans, we identify with everything.
Yeah.
So it has to come from what we're like just all in.
Yeah.
We're in this soup together.
Yeah. Thank you, Una, one of our teachers here. Yeah, I think that's another really important part of this investigation, to not separate what enlightened society looks like or confused society looks like as a separate, completely distinct investigation from what a awakened person or a confused person looks like.
Yeah, so it's actually evidence of Buddha nature.
Yeah,
because we identify that ability we have to just merge with things and identify with things.
Yeah.
It's Buddha nature. And then we merge with aggression.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you all. And maybe we could just set a little intention or aspiration if you'd like to join me before we bow out. And maybe that intention could just be very simply about wanting to lessen dukkha, both in ourselves and others. Have a great night.
Thank you, Shastri. Thanks for listening. For more information about classes and weekend retreats at the New York Shambhala Center, go to ny.shambhala.org. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center. There is one in Boston, there's one in San Francisco, L.A., there's a couple in L.A., in the L.A. area, there's London, I'm not going to go through them all, Toronto, Montreal, Montreal, but, you live in a city, you live a modern lifestyle, you have a smartphone, perhaps you want to find some meditation, some peace in your life. Look up Shambhala. And keep listening to the podcast. And I'm going to eat some cake.